From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Global warming and the rush to the Arctic. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Russia's most famous Arctic explorer, Artur Chilingadov, has placed a titanium flag on the seabed beneath the North Pole. Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper is just back from the Arctic Ocean, where he made plans for an Army training center and a deepwater port. Melting ice may free up both the Northwest Passage and one quarter of the world's undiscovered oil and natural gas. On To the Point, it's the wild, wild west all over again. Will the U.S. stake its own claims? What are the prospects for international conflict? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Pentagon contracts with a man called an international merchant of death. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. Global climate change is melting the ice above the Arctic Circle, creating a rush to control new shipping lanes and untold riches beneath the sea. On To the Point, will the Russian flag beneath the North Pole be a Sputnik moment for the United States? We heard about domestic politics and the potential for international conflict. On Reporter's Notebook, America's missing weapons in Iraq. Was the world's most notorious arms dealer part of the action? First, this news update. For the second time in 2 weeks, Mattel has announced a toy recall. This time it's 9 million toys, once again made in China, recalled because of magnets children can swallow or because of lead paint. Nicholas Casey reports for the Wall Street Journal, which has been ahead on this story. Nicholas, good to have you with us.
Hi, thank you.
Before we get to the implications for Mattel and for China, let's break it down a bit. The lead paint, I gather, is on cars called Sarge cars from the movie
That's
Cars.
Right. Yeah, the Sarge cars is one of the characters from the movie Cars, and there's about a 250,000 toys that are being recalled from that. Although this new lead, recall is much smaller than some of the magnetic recalls which are taking place here. These range in the millions. There's a Batman figurine. This is about 300,000, a little more than 600,000 of a Barbie playset. A million of what are called doggy daycare sets. And sort of the whopping one is the 7.3 million Polly Pocket sets, which are being recalled. It's over a five-year period, it appears. So it's a range of time that sort of this has been taken back from. So people are going to have to be sort of looking back, sort of into when they bought these things. So yeah.
So they might actually have them and have had them for some period of time. Isn't Mattel then suggesting that it's liable in the event that somebody gets hurt by them?
Well, it could be. There are a lot of people who could be liable in this. There are also sort of the retailers. I believe there's also sort of several sort of suits which have been filed already in district courts in California and elsewhere, sort of accusing Mattel of this. There haven't been, so far to my knowledge, sort of any reported injuries related to the lead currently. But still, it opens both retailers, and manufacturers, toy makers up to just a huge slew of litigation which can follow.
Lead is toxic if it's ingested by young children, and the magnets, I take it, can break up and then in children's stomachs clump together?
Yes, that's right. The magnets are far more sinister even than the lead, although the lead is a serious issue here. In the case of the magnets, what's happened is that in recent years, small, very highly powerful magnets have been able to be produced in children's toys. What many toy makers didn't realize when they were beginning to use them is that if swallowed, these could actually begin to go through the digestive tract, and as opposed to passing through, they'll actually begin to clump together, and in some cases, there have been deaths reported after children have had some of their stomach lining and intestines ripped by these magnets as they are passing through and trying to clump together by the magnetic force.
Talking with Nicholas Casey of the Wall Street Journal. There are a couple of phone numbers you can call. I'll give them out, and we'll have them on our website, kcrw.com/to the point. For the magnets, if you want to know about those, 888-597-6597. That's 888-597-6597. For the cars, the lead paint, 800-916-6597. 800-916-4997. That's 800-916-4997. Again, you can find them on our website. Well, Nicholas Casey, this is a blow for Mattel in China because of the previous recall. Apparently, one of the toy manufacturers committed suicide.
Yeah, that was the case. We learned this on Sunday, actually, that the owner of Leader Industrial Company, sort of a Hong Kong-based company that had also had a manufacturing facility in Guangdong province in China, reportedly hung himself over this. It's very much reflective of the increased pressure that's going on right now against these manufacturers that have produced tainted toys. Unfortunately, you know, he is sort of the first casualty of this, but it really does reflect some of the increased tensions we've got between Western companies who've got a completely different set of standards approaching Chinese manufacturers. The standards are much more lax. Many of these guys are not prepared for what's going to happen. In China, lead recalls, they don't make the news in the same way. The idea of having tainted lead isn't a huge scandal. So when one of these blows up in the faces of one of these manufacturers, this often comes as a surprise. We don't have information to know that this individual committed suicide because of this, but certainly you have to wonder with the timing.
China makes roughly 80% of the toys sold worldwide. You've spoken with the president of Mattel. What does he have to say?
Well, right now, the president of Mattel is saying that their approach to restoring consumer confidence is being as open as they can about the recall process and what's going on. In this case, they have been a bit more open sort of than the last case. We worked for about a week to try to get them to reveal the name of the manufacturer that had produced the toys, Leader Industrial Company. In this case, they've already sort of announced the name and also the name of the subcontractor that provided the paint. So I think Mattel has really taken a look at sort of the tide of consumer interest, and also the tide of sort of media interest in this, and it's attempting to be more transparent in this recall than perhaps it was in the initial one.
All right. Holiday season, of course, coming up. Those numbers again for cars, 800-916-4997. For the magnets, 888-597-6597. Nicholas Casey, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Again, a reporter stationed in Los Angeles for the Wall Street Journal. In a moment, global warming and the rush to the Arctic on To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. CNN calls it an irony that even Al Gore might appreciate. As global warming causes the polar ice caps to recede, frozen oceans become navigable, and undiscovered oil and natural gas becomes accessible. A Russian explorer has placed his nation's flag, titanium flag, on the seabed beneath the North Pole. Canada's prime minister is staking claim to the Northwest Passage. Mackenzie Funk wrote an article called Cold Rush. It's the cover story for the current issue of Harper's Magazine. Mackenzie Funk, welcome to our program. Mackenzie Funk, you with us? We seem to have a problem with Mackenzie Funk. It's a wonderful article. It's about going out on a Canadian ship as the Canadians, as Mackenzie Funk puts it, are trying to bare their teeth, establish claim to the Northwest Passage, and setting up a military base and other kinds of things in order to make sure that everybody knows they are there. We'll get back to Mackenzie Funk, I hope, in a moment. Meantime, let's turn to Franklin Griffith. He is a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Toronto. He's an expert on the Arctic and on Russian affairs. We'll be talking about Russia as well. Professor Griffiths, welcome to you.
Yes, glad to be here.
How important is it that your prime minister has just come back from the Arctic Ocean, where he's trying to establish that Canada really does have jurisdiction over the Northwest Passage?
Actually, in the large scheme of things, not very important at all. We have some differences with the United States and other countries on the Northwest Passage, whether those waters are Canadian or whether they're international and a strait. But I think those agreements are longstanding. Nobody wants to heat up a fight on this one. And we and you in the U.S. are managing it fairly nicely. The Russians are doing some grandstanding, it seems to me, in the high Arctic, and in some way the Prime Minister of Canada may be responding by saying we're up there too, but we've been up there for a long time, and nobody's going to come steaming into the Canadian Arctic, I believe. So I'd say, if you ask me in a nutshell, our prime minister is there for political, electoral reasons.
Well, no surprise, I suppose, inasmuch as electoral politics are the motivation for every politician. How do they work for him, and what does he expect to get out of it?
Well, there is in Canada traditionally a set of worries, apprehensions, and resentments regarding your country, the USA. And we traditionally have had a kind of anti-American element or tendency here. And one way that can be expressed is to get on the bandwagon for Arctic sovereignty, which says, thou, the United States, shall never control this, it's ours. And therefore, there is a certain political mileage to be had, I won't say in grandstanding, but in solidifying the Canadian position, presence, saying the right words about the Arctic. But it is electoral, I think, and it's we don't have a real problem with the United States, in my view, nor are we likely to in the future if we talk to one another.
Professor Emeritus Franklin Griffiths at the University of Toronto. Now we have Mackenzie Funk on the line. He writes for Harper's Magazine. He's author of this month's cover story, Cold Rush, The Coming Fight for the Melting North. And Mackenzie Funk, good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What's at stake here? Not just the Northwest Passage, but what about the mineral resources and the petroleum resources beneath the sea?
Well, in my understanding is I went up there last summer on Operation Lancaster, which was a sovereignty operation much like the one that's happening now, and a Canadian sovereignty operation. And that was all about the Northwest Passage, but the global focus seems to be a lot more about mineral resources, and that's in part because Arctic shipping, though it will be short range in the near term, the idea of sending ships through the Northwest Passage or through the Northern Sea Route, the Northeast Sea Route, which would be above Russia, or even over the top of the pole, that's a long way off. And by the time the world gets that warm, we're going to have bigger problems than getting our stuff to port more cheaply.
So in the meantime, what's on the bottom and what's likely to become more accessible, I take it, even before the passageways open up?
Well, that is what's said to be by one USGS estimate, which is being revised now, so the number's not too solid, but they say about a quarter of the world's undiscovered petroleum resources. And that is certainly, I don't know, I can't put a dollar value to that now, but it's certainly looking a lot more appealing. It's not just global climate change that's driving this interest, but gas prices in general and instability in regions that have traditionally given us a lot of our oil and gas. You know, look at Nigeria or Venezuela or, of course, the Middle East, and you'll see that a lot of the traditional spots where we would look for oil and gas are not so appealing now.
So which countries, then, have the biggest stake in this, the biggest likelihood of being able to establish ownership or sovereignty over those resources?
Well, the basic way it works is there's the law of the sea, which I didn't hear at all, but Franklin may have been talking about that. But it is a law that will allow each country to claim a bit of the seabed if they can prove that it's a natural extension of their continental shelf. So the countries that have the most to gain, in one sense, are those that have the longest coastline and the most they can prove the most. That is to say that Russia is looking to get a very large chunk of the Arctic, as we've seen in the recent news. They're making moves to do that. But Canada could also get quite a bit. And the other three Arctic nations, namely the States via Alaska, and Denmark via Greenland, and Norway via Svalbard and its own coastline, those can also get significant chunks of the Arctic, and the where the lines are going to be drawn is still up in the air. But I think Russia in particular is going to keep on growing.
But the point, as I understand it, about the law of the sea that you were making in your article, or one of the many points you were making in your article, and the idea of the Canadians baring their teeth trying to establish bases in that area, is that under the law of the sea, you have to be able to demonstrate that you've been there. You either use it or lose it, according to the Prime Minister of Canada. Is that right?
That's right. And the law of the sea is a wide-ranging law, and I'm far from an expert on it. But these are two separate parts of the law of the sea. One is the idea of the Northwest Passage, and there's something about international straits in the law of the sea. There's also a clause about ice-covered waters, and those two things are what comes into play up in the Canadian Arctic. And then this all the stuff about the continental shelf and the seabed is a separate clause, an entirely different part of the law. So it's one law and lots of different things. About the user to lose it, that means that, you know, basically if we can, if Canada can say, look, this is not an international waterway, there are no ships going through here, then that sort of cuts down the U.S. argument and that made by other countries that this is an international strait and should be open to all.
Again, Mackenzie Funk writes for Harper's Magazine. His current story and the cover story of the current issue is a cold rush, the coming fight for the melting north. Well, we have all heard about the Russian explorer who has gone to the bottom of the sea in a submarine, actually two submarines, and set a titanium flag there beneath the North Pole. Andrei Kortunov is president of the New Eurasia Foundation in Moscow. He's former foreign policy advisor to President Boris Yeltsin. Mr. Kortunov, thank you very much for joining us.
Welcome.
We just heard about domestic politics in Canada. How big a splash was it, if that's the right term, when the flag was placed at the bottom of the North Pole? How big did that go in Russia?
Well, I think that it was a deliberate attempt to make a show and basically to boost Russian patriotism or nationalism. The whole story was well covered by the Russian media. And I think that those who participated in the expedition were portrayed as heroes. And this is important because Russia has a tradition of Arctic exhibitions, and I think that there is a tradition of glorifying those who participate in these expeditions.
Well, tell us about Artur Chilingarov, who was the hero who led this expedition. Now, what else does he do?
Well, he's a member to the State Duma of the Russian Federation, but he is quite a showman at the same time. He is well known in Russia. He led a couple of expeditions, not just to the Arctic, but also to the Southern Pole. And he's clearly well connected in the Kremlin. Definitely, he was able to stage the whole thing, to organize it, and to get it funded. And I'm sure that this expedition will be used to boost budgets of those agencies in Russia that are involved in exploration of Arctic waters.
Well, how serious is Russia, do you think, about actually developing the petroleum and natural gas resources beneath the Arctic Ocean?
Well, in theory, it is one of major repositories of oil and gas that Russia can claim. However, I don't think that in any foreseeable future they are going to start drilling. First of all, because they have a lot of untapped resources much closer to the shores of Russia. And it is also clear that practical exploration of these resources close to the North Pole will be immensely difficult, will be immensely expensive, and will require a new generation of technologies that Russia doesn't have right now. Even the current attempts to explore the nearest gas fields and oil fields in the Barents Sea turned out to be an extremely difficult enterprise for such a big gas company as Gazprom.
So is it worth it then, given the fact that Russia already has enormous gas and oil resources of its own that are much easier to get to?
Well, I think that, first of all, it's a political show, and I think that politicians in Russia want to demonstrate to their own electorate, but also to the rest of the world, that Russia is back, that Russia is getting more assertive in the Arctic region. And second, it can be considered as a long-term investment, just to make a claim right now, to keep the foot in the doorway, and maybe later this is something that will have practical consequences.
Again, Andrei Kortunov is president of the New Eurasia Foundation in Moscow. We'll come back to him and to Professor Griffiths and Mackenzie Funk as well. But first, let's get a perspective from the United States. Mead Treadwell is chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. He's also a senior fellow at the Institute of the North. I should say he's not speaking on behalf of the United States government in this conversation. Mead Treadwell, good to have you with us.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. The U.S. is not even a signatory to the Law of the Sea, the treaty, which would allow it to make a claim. Is that right?
We have not ratified the Law of the Sea. This administration, as well as previous administrations, have submitted it to the Senate for ratification, and it so far failed, but we are trying to abide by it.
Why has it not been ratified?
Well, I think there's a lot of concern, mostly about non-Arctic issues, that it submits U.S. control to U.N. Bureaucracies on certain issues and so forth. But I would say that discussions I've had with sides pro and con all feel that we should not ignore the resources up in the Arctic.
Are the oil companies pushing pretty hard for it?
You know, Andre said, this is not immediate territory, but you have to remember we bought Alaska in 1867. It took 90 years before the Swanson River discovery and close to 100 years before the Prudhoe Bay discovery. But if we hadn't made that purchase, we wouldn't have had that oil. So people are looking at this over a long-term view.
Long-term, and again, it might not even be accessible for decades. Is that right?
That's correct.
Tell us more about how the United States might stake a claim and how its claims might compare to those of Canada and Russia, which we've heard about so far.
Yeah, well, our commission is involved in a working group the State Department has pulled together now to look at putting together a U.S. claim. And the estimate is that the United States in its extended continental shelf would gain about two Californias. The area north of Alaska, about 400 miles north, we believe the shelf extends. So it doesn't go as far as the pole or the 45% of the Arctic Ocean the Russians might claim, but it is a lot. We have had the icebreaker Healy out there several years in a row because of an accident. The mapping mission was canceled last summer, but NOAA has been working the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration has been working to do mapping in preparation for a claim. President Bush has $8 million in the federal budget this year to begin what we expect to be totally about a $50 million mapping exercise before the U.S. could submit a claim, assuming we do ratify.
You've called this, or you've said that you wouldn't be unhappy to hear it called, the Wild Wild West.
Now there's not a whole lot of overlapping claims. The issue of where whether it's the Eurasian continental shelf or the North American continental shelf that reaches the pole may be a bit of a scientific dispute and so forth, but it is one chance the law of the sea gives all these coastal nations to go out and extend their territory.
Okay, we're going to hear more about the situation at the North Pole and beneath it and with regard to the Northwest Passage and oil and gasoline, natural gas underneath the floor of the sea. We'll also talk about the environment in addition to the kinds of international conflicts that might occur because of the new availability of sea lanes and resources. On Reporter's Notebook, we'll talk about the Pentagon and an international arms dealer famous for working both sides of the fence. Is he responsible for missing weapons? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Once again, talking about global warming, what might happen 50 years from now when sea lanes open up, making accessible shipping between the Atlantic and the Pacific, along, of course, a goal of every nation that does shipping, and also the new accessibility of what are thought to be as much as a quarter of the world's oil and natural gas. Eric Posner is professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's also co-author of a book, The Limits of International Law. Professor Posner, good to have you with us. Professor Posner is not with us. We will go back then to Mead Treadwell, and let me ask you, earlier we were talking about the fact that there are people in the U.S. Senate who are worried about U.N. control, and that's one of the reasons that the Law of the Sea hasn't been ratified by the Senate, even though it's been signed by the executive branch, I believe, even before President Bush. What about environmentalists, and are they, for interesting reasons, now finding themselves in alliance with the oil companies?
Well, as McKinsey mentioned before, there's two aspects of the Law of the Sea that specifically relate to the Arctic or have brought a lot of attention to the Arctic. One is this territorial extension or extension of the continental shelf, the country's economic zone at the seabed. The other is, and that's Article 76, the other is Article 234, which allows nations with typically ice-covered waters to extend new environmental regulations outside their territory in order to protect their territorial interests. And in fact, even as the U.S. and Canada may disagree over the sovereignty issues of the Northwest Passage, for example, our country and Canada have agreed through the Law of the Sea Treaty that we should have special provisions to protect the environment of the Arctic.
Now, that would mean against oil spills and other kinds of things that that might occur. What does the current law hold, and who's responsible if, in fact, there's an accident?
Well, if there's an accident on the high seas, there's various IMO provisions and so forth. If the accident happens within a country's boundaries, each country has its own rules.
Okay, let me go back to Andrei Kortunov at the New Eurasia Foundation in Moscow. We just heard that the United States and Canada probably can make common ground with regard to environmental regulations. I'm just interested in Russia's attitude toward those. And is that something of concern in Russia and to those that might be involved in any kind of development if it ever occurred?
Well, it becomes a matter of concern because the environment in the Arctic region is very fragile, and Russia will be one of the countries to suffer a lot if the environmental balance is disrupted. Unfortunately, right now, environmental issues are used primarily as a political weapon. For example, when state wants to deprive an oil company from its rights, it usually raises environmental issues. So they are used arbitrarily. And therefore, many doubt the integrity of the state policy on these issues. I think that over time, Russian standards of environment are going to get closer to that of the United States and of Canada. So we are moving in this direction, but we are moving slowly.
Once again, the book, The Limits of International Law, becomes relative at this point. We've been talking a lot about international law. Co-author of that book, Eric Posner, professor of law at the University of Chicago. Professor, thanks again for being with us.
Nice to be here.
You've said that it's not going to be international law that settles these issues. It's going to be power.
Well, there are a couple of reasons for that. One here, as is often the case, the Law of the Sea Treaty is extremely ambiguous, partly by design and partly just in the nature of things. It's very difficult to plan for many years in advance and to anticipate the ice cap melting and so forth. And so this ambiguity gives states the ability to assert their interests. And generally, when the more powerful states assert their interests, they'll prevail.
Well, doesn't the Law of the Sea also provide in some way that the victory will be won by those who have established that they have a presence in the area that they're trying to claim?
Well, I'm not sure that's true for the specific issue of the continental shelf. I mean, you do have to act. You do have to make submissions in order to assert your claim to the continental shelf if certain conditions are met. But the problem is that, as I mentioned, the treaty is ambiguous, and then there are various dispute resolution mechanisms, but they don't really do the work that would be necessary to resolve the issues. So in the end, I think as a matter of practice, the states that invest a great deal of effort in making their presence clear in the Arctic and their interests clear are going to do a lot better than states that do not. And partly what's impressive about what has happened in the last few weeks is that Russia has gone ahead and done just this, demonstrating its technological expertise and its ambition. And I think Canada and the United States now have to catch up.
Mead Treadwell, back to you with the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. You said that that's beginning to happen here in the United States, but we're kind of behind, are we not, in terms of what's been done by Canada and Russia?
Well, we're behind on ratification of the Law of the Sea, that's for sure. But let me make it clear. I think America's interest in the Arctic as an observer are very strong. We do intend, and we are going forward with mapping our extraterritorial claim or extended continental shelf claim under the Law of the Sea Treaty, even before ratification. The Senate last month reported out a new requirement for the Coast Guard to build two new polar-class icebreakers. We have the Healy, but the two existing heavy icebreakers that you'll see mostly at the docks in Seattle are ailing right now, ending they were built or commissioned over 30 years ago, and it's time for two new icebreakers. So, I mean, the United States is looking at, we just had a conference sponsored by the Coast Guard, the Navy, our commission, and others, to the National Ice Center to look at operations in the Arctic. And I think the United States will probably come through and build two new icebreakers in the next decade.
Franklin Griffiths, back to you, Professor Emeritus at the University of Toronto.
Right.
Given the relative power of the United States, Canada, and Russia, Canada sort of needs the United States, does it not, if it comes down to a show of power?
What I'd like to say is that basically we are witnessing the birth of a region. This is a part of the world that has been, shall we say, frozen in a whole lot of ways. There's been military strategic competition and conflict for a long time, but now we're playing with almost a full deck of cards up there. There's the environment, there's all kinds of economic development resource, there's geopolitics, all coming into full play. And it seems to me we have a very important moment here to get things right, and not simply to translate expectations and prior experiences from other regions to a place in the world that's really very special, the Arctic. It seems to me, in other words, we should try to get it right. We should realize, a lot of us, that in fact, I'd say all of us, that throughout the Arctic countries, the north is different from the south. The capitals are always in the south. The decision makers are in the south. They, on the whole, know very little about the north and the Arctic. I'd say one thing that can do, what we can do to help correct this, that's done in the Arctic Council, which is where we all meet, is to see to it that some of the local people who live up in the north are directly represented at the table. What would they say about this conversation we're having, I wonder? They'd have to say, this is great power politics, scramble for resources. It's really an ignorance of the environment, and indeed of the people and the wildlife that live up there. I put in two bits for that latter agenda.
Again, Franklin Griffiths at the University of Toronto. Back to Mackenzie Funk, author once again of the cover story in the current Harper's Magazine, Cold Rush, The Coming Fight for the Melting North. In your story, you talk a lot about the environmental issues and about the local people, the native population, for whom, I suppose, this is more important personally than it is for anybody else.
Well, yeah, this is, as Professor Griffiths just said, there's a big irony here, and that's, of course, that we're expending all this energy to, you know, get a piece of the Arctic when we could be expending all that energy on combating climate change, which is what has gotten us here in the first place. And that's the underlying irony of the whole story, is that we're doing all this thinking about adaptation, and that is smart because there's some built-in warming in the world for the next 50 years, whether we like it or not, no matter what we do with carbon, it's going to warm. But at some point, we should stop thinking about drilling more oil such that we can heat up the world more, such that we can drill more oil, and think about the locals indeed, and think about oil spills. It turns out that one of the best ways to deal with oil spills in the Arctic at this moment, given that all the problems with the ice and putting out ice booms, is to simply burn it off. And that's when you're burning a huge oil spill off is the best way to deal with it. That's certainly, it's not pretty.
To what extent have the people who live above the Arctic Circle, Mackenzie Funk, already have had to adapt their lifestyles to the changes made by the warming temperatures and the melting of the ice?
Well, the main contact I had while I was up there was with a few Canadian Rangers, which is an Inuit force that working with the Canadian forces as a mostly auxiliary troops, but they're there as the eyes and ears of the North, as they're known. And I talked with a few of them and also with the commissioner of Nunavut, Ann Hansen. And they're, you know, their world is changing. Commissioner Hansen said something interesting. That was that in traditional forecasting, they'd had eight separate seasons that they could know about. And now they only had six. So they weren't exactly sure when the ice would change, when it was safe to go out on the ice. And they're you know, their world is changing before their eyes, and that was very clear to all of them.
Professor Posner at the University of Chicago, under international law, what rights do the Inuit have when we're talking here, as Professor Griffiths pointed out, in terms of power politics, politics between countries, most of whose residents have absolutely nothing to do whatsoever with what goes on above the Arctic?
Well, there are some treaties that try to protect the rights of indigenous peoples, and from time to time, the Inuit and others have tried to make claims under these treaties. They're not the treaties themselves are weak. The claims usually don't go anywhere. They have strong moral arguments, as we've heard, but the legal arguments are pretty weak, for the obvious reason that they don't make international law. The governments do. I don't see them having any particular claim pertaining to the continental shelf issue under the law of the sea or any other international law.
What about claims that might have to do with the kinds of things Mackenzie Funk was just talking about, oil spills and other consequences of development of that area?
Well, I don't know enough about the status of the indigenous peoples under international law to be able to answer that question. Certainly, in the law of the sea and in other treaty instruments, claims can be made, and also under customary international law, claims can be made against states that fail to prevent pollution from occurring and against companies that violate the law and cause oil spills and other environmental damage.
Mead Treadwell, let me go back to you, Chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission and fellow at the Institute of the North. The United States has a ghastly history when it comes to Native populations. Is there any concern in the development of that you talked about earlier about the rights of the people who live in that area?
Absolutely. And let me correct a few things. Well, I think Professor Posner is right about standing under international law. The United States, Canada, and the other six Arctic nations have made a very strong point of bringing indigenous groups to the table at the Arctic Council, and the indigenous representatives are permanent participants, and their voice is heard. In Alaska, I can give you two examples. There was to be some major offshore oil exploration going on this summer. The native North Slope Borough sued and prevented that. This time, there's actually a workshop we'll be participating in September that will be going further and deeper on these oil spill issues, on the subsistence issues. There are times when we have actually moved the track of U.S. Coast Guard icebreakers in order to avoid any interference with subsistence whaling. And, you know, I can say that from our standpoint at the commission I don't know any place where the U.S. government is not trying to bring in the native voice here as we go through these issues. And we're certainly not ignoring climate change, as McKinsey suggested.
Once again,
of money that we spend on climate change research is far and away beyond what's being spent on mapping. And, in fact, one of the reasons why we're promoting the mapping research is it gives us a platform to do more climate change research.
Once again, the most dramatic gesture recently in this area is the planting of the titanium flag on the bottom of the sea beneath the North Pole. Let me go back to Andrei Kortunov at the New Eurasia Foundation in Moscow. What about concerns in Moscow about the indigenous people? We talked earlier about the environment. And more basic and important question, I think, for this conversation, what's liable to happen next in Russia? Will the government do anything pursuant to the planting of the flag anytime soon?
Well, I don't think that we will see any drilling anytime soon in this particular region, but definitely Russia is moving to the north. We could see new arrangements, for example, with the French company Total to start exploration of the so-called Stockman gas field in the Barents Sea. We know of other plans to explore oil and gas resources on the shelf of the Siberian coast of Russia. And definitely Russia is going to expand to the north, especially because some of the major repositories of gas and oil in Siberia are getting almost depleted. And even to maintain the current level of gas and oil production, Russia must move to the north. The only question is whether it is environmentally friendly, whether it has the technology, whether it will do it unilaterally or in consortium with other major foreign companies.
And what about the native populations?
Well, usually it's a question of social responsibility of big businesses. And, of course, each Russian oil company and gas company wants to claim that it is socially responsible. And usually they have a separate budget line to assist indigenous peoples. However, the fact is that the lifestyle of these peoples is changing. It's not just a matter of environment. It's not just a matter of protecting the nature. But when you see very large-scale technological projects, when you see a lot of migrations to the area, when you see new social economic infrastructure in deserted areas, of course it has its impact on indigenous people. And of course you cannot preserve their lifestyle as they are right now.
Mackenzie Funk, quickly back to you. A final question. You're on your way back into that region, as I understand it. What are you looking for?
Well, I'm on the Healy icebreaker that Mead just mentioned, and I want to say I was just getting the helicopter flight plan for the transfer from Barrow, Alaska, and there is indeed much talk of making sure we're not in the way of the whaling hunt. So, yeah, we'll be going a month into the up toward the Chukchi Cap and doing a mapping mission to basically get ready in case the U.S. does sign the Law of the Sea.
All right. Well, thank you all very much for being with us. Mackenzie Funk of Harper's, Andrei Kortunov in Moscow, Franklin Griffiths at the University of Toronto, Mead Treadwell at the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, and Eric Posner, a professor of law at the University of Chicago. We'll try to keep track of this story and keep our listeners up to date as time goes on. Bound for Iraqi security forces, 110,000 AK-47 assault rifles and 80,000 pistols have disappeared. The Government Accountability Office calls it bureaucratic bungling, but it could be the work of a man who stoked wars in Africa, sold planes to the Taliban, and still got contracts to ship American weapons. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In the 1990s, Victor Boot was a target of U.S. intelligence, which wanted to end his role in illegal arms traffic worldwide. But even after public revelations about his activities, Boot became a weapons contractor for the Pentagon. In 2004, four of Boot's planes were supposed to ship 99 tons of AK-47s and other weapons from Bosnia to Iraq. There is no record that they ever got there. Stephen Braun writes for the Los Angeles Times. He's co-author of a book about Victor Boot, Merchant of Death, Money, Guns, Planes, and the Man Who Makes War Possible. Stephen Braun, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Is there any apparent connection between this shipment of Boot's from Bosnia to Iraq and the recent reports about the AK-47s and pistols that have gone missing?
Well, it's hard to know because the GAO report doesn't reference the Boot shipments. Actually, the shipments were on an air cargo firm called Aerocom, which has been linked to Boot's operation. So we don't know whether the 99 tons of AK-47s and clips, et cetera, were part of the 190,000 AK-47s and other guns that the GAO is talking about, or whether they're another shipment. And even more confusing, there's a new report out just yesterday by the Associated Press about yet another scheme to transport apparently contraband AK-47s, something like 100,000 of them, into Iraq, a plot that was foiled by Italian authorities. So it's clear that there's something going on here in terms of how these AK-47s are making their way in, supposedly, to the Iraqi Defense Ministry. And you know, the larger question here, there are two larger questions. I mean, one is, you know, where are these AKs going? Are they going to the government itself? Are they going to insurgents? Are they going to, you know, rival sectarian groups? And then the other question is the one that I dealt with the other day, which is the question of, you know, we know of we and both Amnesty International have documented these Aerocom flights that Boot flew and these weapons that apparently the U.S. can't track, raises also larger questions of how we mind our bad guys, you know, who we hire, who's got, you know, a disreputable reputation, and how do we ensure that they don't come back to haunt us later on?
Victor Boot, so disreputable that you report that in the 1990s, U.S. intelligence wanted to make him a subject of rendition, get him out of the way. How is it that he came to have contracts after that time with the Pentagon for shipping all these weapons around?
Well, that's, again, it's because this guy operates in the shadows, it's hard to know. But we have heard from some Western European intelligence officials and from some of Boot's allies themselves that there were overtures made by Boot's organization to the U.S. Right around the time that we invaded Afghanistan. Part of the reason is that Boot had been dealing with the Taliban and indirectly at Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan for about 5 years prior to September 11th, flying in about $50 million worth of arms, selling them air cargo planes. I mean, basically helping the Taliban, you know, find independent sources of armaments. After September 11th, Boot made these overtures. Don't know whether they were accepted or not. But what we do know that is in mid 2003, all of a sudden his air cargo lines are beginning to fly hundreds and hundreds of flights into Baghdad. Everything from the Aerocom flights that flew weaponry from both Bosnia and from Bulgaria, and other air firms of his that flew tents. They flew on behalf of the U.S. Army. They flew on behalf of KBR, DynCorp, FedEx. And these flights continued up until 2006. And the real irony here was this was all happening at a time when the Treasury Department was trying to shut his operation down with financial sanctions. So on the one hand, you had the Treasury Department trying to put him out of business, and on the other hand, the DOD is giving him millions in U.S. taxpayer dollars.
The DOD and KBR, Kellogg Brown Root, one of the big contractors in Iraq. Well, tell us a bit more about the background of Victor Boot, to whom you referred to a bad guy, and what is his record in terms of double dealing with various people around the world?
Well, he's played both sides of the fence for a long time. In Afghanistan, for example, he started out by flying on behalf of the legitimate government there, which at the time the defense minister was Ahmed Shah Massoud, now recognized as a hero of Afghanistan, who had been assassinated by al-Qaeda agents just before September 11th. But after about 5 years, he switched sides and was working not openly but covertly with the Taliban. Same thing happened in Angola and a number of other African countries where he would fly in arms both for the government and for warlords fighting against those governments. He has a reputation for a decade of arming a lot of the conflicts in Africa, and that's why we began to target him in the late 1990s, an effort, unfortunately, that never quite got off the ground.
So arming both sides of the wars in Africa, he was helpful to Charles Taylor at one time, was he not?
He was. He was Taylor's prime armaments guy, and in fact to the point where Taylor glowingly called him his pepper bush, which is a term of endearment, largely because he could depend on Boot's arms transfer, as Boot wasn't a particularly effusive guy, but he was reliable. They called him the postman because he always delivered. He built this fleet of about 60 Russian air cargo planes that flew these repeated circles around the circuits around the world, the Mideast, Africa. They would fly into one place. They'd drop off a load of anything from AK-47s to disassembled helicopter gunships. They could fly out with anything from frozen chickens to flowers to blood diamonds, which he often used as payment for the weapons that he flew. I mean, he was very flexible, and he was very canny in the way that he created his sort of shape-shifting organization.
So, again, we have a guy with this background. The U.S. Treasury Department is trying to put him out of business at the same time that he gets contracts that allow him to make, as you reported, hundreds of flights into Baghdad. Now, were these contracts directly with the Pentagon, or were these what are called second-tier contractors?
Paul Wolfowitz described them that way. Many of them were second, and in some cases, third-tier contracts. And this is where the real loopholes are created. I mean, in essence, the Pentagon officials claim they really had no responsibility for this because this was the responsibility of the contractors and not them. But it raised, you know, central questions of how was it that here was a guy who, you know, was regarded by the Treasury Department and even earlier by national security officials as a true transnational threat. How is he suddenly flying into the high security zone in Baghdad? And it raised questions, well, if he could do it, couldn't a terrorist organization also create some sort of a fly-by-night and get into the heart of Baghdad?
All right. We'll try to follow this one as it develops. Stephen Brun, thanks so much for being with us. National correspondent, L.A. Times, Merchant of Death, Money, Guns, Planes, and the Man Who Makes War Possible, co-author of that book. Today's program produced by Dan Konecki with Vanessa Romo and Karen Radziner. Our technical director is Mike Newport. For more information about To The Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To The Point. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.